For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we're investigating some novels inspired by the golden age of crime writing. Louise Hare takes us on board the Queen Mary for a transatlantic cruise with a side order of murder in her new book, Miss Aldridge Regrets. Stuart Turton blends Agatha Christie, Cluedo, Groundhog Day, and Quantum Leap, then lets the murderer mayhem fizz in his dazzling debut, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. And Vicky Goldie introduces us to her blind detective and reveals how he was inspired by both her husband and Agatha Christie. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Louise Hare's atmospheric debut, This Lovely City, was set in bombed-out post-war London and placed a couple from the Windrush generation at the heart of a tender love story wrapped up in a whodunit. The novel received rave reviews, and Louise's follow-up has been eagerly anticipated. And Miss Aldridge Regrets is no disappointment. Set in 1936 aboard the ocean liner Queen Mary, it's a brilliant murder mystery, combining music and glamour with a probing exploration of race, class and pre-World War II politics. And, as I found out, any resemblance to the works of Agatha Christie or Patricia Highsmith is entirely intentional. Louise, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
You introduce us to Lena Aldridge at a very low point in her life in 1936, when she's singing in a really sleazy Soho bar.
Yes.
It's all going wrong for her.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was imagining myself when I was in my 20s, and you sort of go through your teens having these great dreams of what you're going to end up as, and then it all doesn't work out that way.
Yes, her married boyfriend has left her and she witnesses a murder.
Yes, not ideal.
And just when it all seems like it can't get any worse or any better, somebody makes her an offer which seems too good to refuse.
Yeah, so literally out of the blue, this guy turns up because her father died not that long before the beginning of the novel as well. And so he says, oh, my boss essentially was great friends with your father back in the day and was really sad to hear of his passing and he wants to make things up. And so he wants to offer you this brilliant role on Broadway. And Lena knows it's too good to be true. But then when she goes to work at the club that night and there's a murder, it just seems like, well, why not? It doesn't seem like London's a great place to be at the moment for me. So why not give it a shot?
Yeah, she really has lost everything, as you say, her jazz musician father, her lover and her place of work. And the offer involves a first class ticket over to New York on the luxury liner, the Queen Mary.
Yeah. So originally I was going to create my own ship because I thought maybe it would be easier. But then it turned out because the Queen Mary was so iconic, there's so much information out there. You can get like the whole deck plans and all the photographs of every single public room. And I just lost hours poring over these photographs and going through the information, like everyone who used to sail, you know, the celebrities, the big Hollywood stars like Clark Gable and Fred Astaire and people like that. And I was like, oh, I could really imagine Lena being thrown into this environment with these really rich, sort of wealthy people, imagining those dinner table conversations. And it just, I was like, actually, you know, I'm going to use this because why go to the bother of creating my own ship when somebody's made the perfect ship already?
And as you say, there's a real wealth of information about the Queen Mary. It even had its own newspaper on board.
Yeah, the Ocean Times. So I actually managed to get hold of not a copy from the exact sailing that I put Lena on, but one a couple of months earlier. They've got copies in the British Library that you're allowed to just check out and read there and just look through. So just things like the advertising and see what the entertainment was, which was useful for me because one of the characters is an entertainer on the ship. So seeing, checking, I guess, that what I was writing wasn't completely wrong.
And amazing photographs of all the cabins and rooms and communal areas, which for a writer must be an absolute gift because you can describe them.
Exactly. I mean, there was so much that I almost had to stop myself from describing too much, because you don't want pages and pages just of description. There is a story to tell. But yeah, I mean, it was so nice to immerse myself in working out how to bring the ship to life, because it was so luxurious. There was almost no expense spared. It was built at a time when we were coming out of the Great Depression. So it was almost like, let's show the world that we've got all this money again and we're going to attract the best people to come and travel on it. So yeah, great artworks, and there were a couple of swimming pools on board, so even down to the tiling and that kind of thing.
Now, Lena is traveling cabin class, or first class as it was, but she feels her position quite keenly because she's mixed race, and though she can pass as white, she also feels a bit of an imposter in this very white upper class society on board the ship.
Yeah, very much so. So what I kind of wanted to try and get across was, I suppose, the slight differences between what life would have been like for her in England, in London at that time, and what she might have been preparing herself to expect in New York, where things were a little bit more cut and dry. Like, you know, there were places in New York you would definitely know there's no point in me trying to get in there as a person of colour because I'm not going to be allowed. Where in London, you would just have to go and see. There wasn't a ruling as such as to where you're allowed to go. You just sort of very quietly be asked to, maybe this isn't the place for you. So she's grown up living as someone who can pass as white, but hasn't ever had, you know, had to worry about if someone discovers her secret and discovers that she is mixed race. Whereas now when she's on the Queen Mary, she's been explicitly told, don't let anyone know that you're mixed race, because they might have a problem with it. You might suddenly find yourself in third class or something. If there's a complaint, we don't know what will happen. So yeah, it's a strange time for her. Obviously, there's a lot of upheaval in her life anyway. So it's just an added stress for her at a time when she probably doesn't really need any more stress.
No, and the epitome of that American wealth, privilege and exclusiveness is the rather vile Abernathy family, who she seems to end up sitting near all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a reason why she's been placed in that position, that she doesn't realize it at the beginning. But because I think when people don't realize that, you know, if you look like one of the crowd, I think people are less guarded in what they say. So obviously a couple of times people say racist things in front of her because they think she's one of them. So I wanted to put that across a little bit. But also, I mean, it's so much fun writing horrible characters. So yeah, I had a blast writing those scenes.
And that really comes through. It's a wonderful slice of golden age of crime fiction. It's very Agatha Christie or Patricia Highsmith. And there is an archness to it that lends itself to awful characters saying awful things.
Yeah, well, when I started writing the novel, I was actually studying on an MA in creative writing. And we just spent a term looking at genre fiction, so like crime fiction, historical fiction, and YA. And one of the set books to read was Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley. And obviously the fun of that book is he's a murderer, but you can't, everyone else is so horrific around him in a very glamorous American way that you want him to get away with it. And so I was quite interested with exploring, not that Lena's a murderer, but sort of exploring how someone can make a lot of mistakes in life, which Lena does do, but you really root for her because, you know, the option is the Abernathys, who are just terrible. And I think another example is something like Donna Tartt's The Secret History. These are really wealthy Americans, and the way that they maybe look down on other people, I don't think that's just an American thing, but those books that I love that I wanted to recreate in my own novel.
Am I right in saying that the genesis for Lena was actually in your previous book, This Lovely City, when the two protagonists go out to a rather sleazy club?
That was the inspiration. So This Lovely City I was writing while I was doing my MA. And then because you have to keep producing new work and you can't duplicate, I couldn't keep putting in different bits of This Lovely City. I had to come up with new stuff. And I'd just written the scene where the two main characters from that book go to a jazz club. That was set in 1950, but the short story was originally set in 1950. And then when I decided to expand it into a novel, the late 30s just, I think, really jumped out at me, because once I decided that I was going to use the Queen Mary, and that was the year of her sailing, it just seemed such an interesting time period. Because I started writing this in 2019 as well, so there was a lot of strange things happening in the world in terms of, like, Trump, and we were still waiting for Brexit to kick in properly, and, you know, all those kind of things. And I thought, actually, there's a lot of parallels that you can think about in terms of those two time periods. So that was why I moved it. But yeah, so the idea originally was that, because I was just like, I need to write a short story, panic. As my original two characters in this, obviously, to leave this club, one of them looks back and sees this woman on stage and wishes she could stay longer and listen to her. And so I just started to think about that woman on stage and who she might be.
And without giving any spoilers, I'm guessing that Lena might reappear in a sequel to this book as well.
Yeah, so I've just written a first draft of that and I'm about to start editing it. And yeah, I guess I'm really lucky that my editors both thought that there was sort of a bit more mileage in the character. I really enjoyed writing Lena because it's from first person, so you do get quite into her head. And so yeah, it's been nice to revisit her. So yeah, I mean, I guess it's not a spoiler because anyone can look up and see that there's a sequel on the way. So yeah, she does end up in New York at the end of the first novel, and then the second novel is set in New York, so it sort of picks up directly actually on the same day that the last book finished.
And as you say, part of your reason for moving her from London to New York is to explore the different reactions that she gets as a mixed race woman in 1930s society against a backdrop of the rise of Nazism. Was life easier for mixed race people in London than New York in the 30s?
I mean, one of the things that I wanted to sort of explore a little bit was, you know, I think one of the things is community makes a difference. And I think perhaps in London at that time, there was a small black community, but, you know, nothing like the community that exists now. And so I think for Lena, especially when her father's died, she does feel a little bit isolated in that regard. And one of the things that I did want to explore in the second book is she ends up in Harlem, living in an area with people that she's met along the way who are all black or mixed race, and she meets other people who could pass as well. And so it's being able to have those conversations, which I'm finding quite interesting in the second book. It's sort of having her find herself a little bit, or to help, I guess, to help understand where she comes from, because her father, as far as she knew, was from New York. So she's going to investigate a bit about his background, because that ties into events that happened in the first book as well. So yeah, it's been really interesting doing the research and reading novels of that period, that early part of the 20th century. And although it's, with it being the 30s, it's set a bit after the Harlem Renaissance. That's an era that's always fascinated me, when you had people like Nella Larsen, for example, who wrote Passing, all these different authors and artists really showing black excellence in the arts. So I wanted to sort of explore that a little bit, and the jazz and you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, as I was listening to the audiobook, I was wishing that you had curated a playlist for me to listen along to, because your research clearly shows just how vibrant, especially the music scene, was in that era.
Yeah, well, I think, unfortunately, you're probably a little bit too early. They have made one, but I've sort of sent one to my publisher to put together. So hopefully people can put that on, and it picks out all the songs that I've referenced in the novel or on the playlist. So hopefully when people do read the novel, they can listen to the playlist as well.
As I said, I've listened to the audiobook, and it is brilliantly brought to life by Georgina Campbell, who has also starred in Broadchurch and Black Mirror. What was it about her voice that made her Miss Aldridge for you?
So I was quite lucky. I got sent a few different recordings of different actors reading bits of different novels or adverts, or, you know, just to listen to their voices. And really, she was the one that I was like, oh, yeah, that really does make me think Lena. I think it is quite important to have somebody narrating who who sounds like the person that you imagine, because, you know, you, as you're writing, you're spending a couple of years with a person and you're almost imagining them talking to you, especially when you're writing in first person. You know, I'm writing in that person's voice. So, yeah, I felt, as soon as I heard her recordings, I was like, yeah, please can we have her?
I had left London that morning, catching the boat train down to Southampton and holding my breath at each station stop until I was sure that the police weren't coming aboard, hot on my trail. Boarding the ship had been finally managed chaos, crowds of people everywhere as families roamed the dock, waiting to wave off their relatives, the Queen looming over us, regal and magnificent. I had felt anonymous in the hubbub, trying to look as though I knew what I was doing, accidentally overtipping the porter who carried my solitary trunk. It was never too early to get used to American customs, Maggie had told me as she waved me off in the taxi from Hampstead. It'll be like learning a role for a play, she'd said. I was good at that. It was getting the roles in the first place that I'd always struggled with up to now.
Georgina Campbell, narrating Miss Aldridge Regrets, written by my guest, Louise Hare.
Louise, one thing blind and partially sighted readers may not be able to see is the beautiful cover to the novel. Could you describe it to us, please?
Yes. So if you think of the 1930s, often you think of architecture and Art Deco. And so it's got a real Art Deco feel to it. And then you've got a figure of Lena shadowed as well, because obviously with her being mixed race but passing, we had to sort of make her slightly less clear, because obviously it becomes a bit challenging to show that. And then we have a little picture of, I'm going to say it's a ship, it's definitely not the Queen Mary, because somebody's already pointed out to me on social media that there's a funnel missing to be the Queen Mary. It's a ship, it's a symbol of the Queen Mary. And yeah, and it's mostly orange and then gold. I guess you would call scalloping around the edges, so I think, which represent the theatre aspect, because she's an aspirational actress as well as singer.
Yes, she really dreams of being part of that whole Clark Gable, Hollywood, Broadway type of society. And the Queen Mary is the ideal setting for her in many ways. It's just a shame that a murderer seems to have followed her on board.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Yeah, I've really got into them, especially over the sort of lockdowns, because I hadn't really thought about them much. With my first novel, we actually had, because there's sort of a jazz theme with that as well, we were quite lucky. We actually managed to get jazz music, especially composed for it, which I thought was awesome, like the best thing that ever happened. And so I did actually listen to bits of the audiobook, because I thought I wouldn't like listening to my own audiobook, but because it's someone else reading it, it feels a bit like I'm listening to someone else's book. It doesn't really feel like my book anymore. And so yeah, so I've been listening to a few over the times when I've really struggled to read anyway, because I think my brain just, definitely the first lockdown, my brain just went, no, it's not happening. But yeah, I'm quite a few of my friends that are really into audiobooks. Like, they don't even read normal books that often anymore. They mainly listen. It used to be on the way to work, but you know, doing the housework. It is quite handy because you can do multiple things at once. If you're a multitasker, then an audiobook's great.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed Miss Aldridge Regrets, and I'm looking forward to reading more about Lena's adventures. But thank you for coming on to the show today to describe more about the background of the book, and I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to the generous support of publisher HarperCollins, Miss Aldridge Regrets has already joined this lovely city in the RNIB library, and Louise Hare will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Top tips from RNIB. If you are heading out to a restaurant with family or friends and aren't able to read the menu, you can probably find it online, so you can just read it before you go, or at the restaurant on your smartphone. Listen out for life hacks, top tips, and advice from people living with sight loss for people living with sight loss, like these across all shows on RNIB Connect Radio. If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Get in touch with us on 0303 123 9999 or visit rnib.org.uk/advice for more information.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Vicky Goldie gives a blind twist to the classic Country House Murder. But first, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is the dazzling debut novel by Stuart Turton that everybody's talking about. A spine-tingling blend of Cluedo, Quantum Leap and Groundhog Day, it's a book I just can't put down. So I'm hoping that he doesn't let anything slip during this interview. Stuart Turton, welcome to Read On.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So I was given The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle because my friends know that I love a good classic crime thriller. And at heart, it is a classic 1920s country house murder, but it's got all sorts of other influences, sci-fi, quantum physics. For those who haven't had the joy of picking it up yet, can you give us a bit of a blurb, please?
I absolutely can. I've always got a blurb at the ready. So it's a, as you say, it's an Agatha Christie-style murder mystery with all those lovely tropes that you would ever want, the isolated manor house, the upper-class guests who all have shady secrets, and then a body at the end of the day, which is the aforementioned Evelyn Hardcastle. But the trick is that the day of her murder keeps repeating over and over again in the Groundhog Day-style loop, and our detective, our protagonist, can't escape that loop until he solves her murder. Now, the big tricksy bit is that every time he wakes up in this loop, he's in the body of a different guest in the house. So he keeps bumping into future hims and past hims, and they mysteriously and very strangely don't actually all want the same thing, which keeps tripping him up.
Fantastic. I'm glad I got you to do that.
Well, that's been 2 years in the making. That's me at a lot of parties scratching my head trying to explain my book to people.
It keeps you turning the pages throughout. What were the influences on you? Were you a crime buff as a young man growing up?
I absolutely wasn't, no. I mean, I'd read Agatha Christie, so they were the first books. At 80 years of old, I had stacks of those, and I just read them and devoured them one after another, and I absolutely loved those and that specific style of mystery story, and that led me on to the other Golden Age crime writers, and I just tore through those. And then I went, well, everybody goes, I went from Sherlock Holmes and then Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And then once I got through those, I kind of just drifted away from the entire genre. So I was kind of almost done with it by the time I was 11 years old, which is very strange. And I didn't come back to it, really, until I wrote this book when I was 33 or 34. So crime wasn't actually a huge influence on it, apart from Agatha Christie and those authors I've just mentioned. There was far more sort of, and that's going to sound incredibly literary and worthy, but it's far more sort of Franz Kafka's The Trial for that sense of unease, Arunati Roy for that sense of that playfulness with time and that ability to sort of like chop and change and have things appear in the wrong order. So I kind of drew a lot from those authors.
As you say, everything about Blackheath House and the surrounding area seems, well, I think one of your characters says, designed to unsettle the nerves. It's a very, very creepy place. And it's corrupt, isn't it? Everything is dripping with decay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because the fundamental problem I had when I first set out to write this novel is that the problem facing my protagonist is somebody says to him, unless you can solve this murder, you can never escape this house. But, you know, on face value, he's in an upper-class house with upper-class moneyed people at this really rich gala party, and then there's a big ball at the end of it, a big costume ball, and it all should be very, very nice. He should be having quite a nice time. And my wife pointed that out early in the writing. She was like, well, why would he ever want to escape? Like, why would he ever want to get out of there? It sounds like he's having a great time. So I had to sort of drape everything in this corruption and this awfulness and make it so that it was as unappealing as possible. And of course, that also ties into what we're doing with the period, which is we're looking at, you know, the inherited wealth and how that's poisoned the people at this house and what they've done with it. And they're basically all the worst archetypes that you could ever imagine. But we try to twist them around and do interesting things with them. But fundamentally, they're all just there to make this guy, my protagonist's sort of journey as hellish as possible.
And there's a real sense of fun and games within the book. I mean, it does read like a Cluedo novel, what with the potential murder weapons and the caricatured butler and footman and the overweight, gluttonous lord. I get a sense that it was very fun to write as well.
Oh, it was the most fun thing. But I knew going into this that it was going to take me a long time to write. I told my wife a year, and when I first set out, a year seemed like a very long time to me. I actually took 2.5 in the end. But I knew that I would have to, because I'm very restless by nature, and that would have to entertain myself every single day I was writing it. I would have to find something in it to keep me going. So that's why, hopefully, it's got that sense of fun, because I was just trying to entertain myself all the way through. And all those archetypes, the sense of games, the sense of play, that all came out of the Agatha Christie. It all came out, for me, every time I read an Agatha Christie, it felt like a board game. It felt like I was sitting down to play opposite Agatha. She would lay out the house for you in great detail. And some of those books had maps, like Arthur's. She would tell you who the characters were, and that would be your list of suspects as well. And then you would have all the weapons and the possibilities. So they always felt like board games, much to the chagrin of my sister, who probably wanted to actually play games with me, but I was, you know, off reading Agatha Christie and playing with her instead. So it all just kind of comes out of the source material, and then me honestly trying to entertain myself and not go completely insane in those 2.5 years.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether anybody's actually managed to guess the outcome early yet, because I feel thoroughly bamboozled. And normally I've got a fairly good sense where a crime novel's going, because I've read so many of them. But and you have this wonderful freedom of you'll give us a clue through the eyes of one character, and then you'll prove it to be a red herring 50 pages later when Aiden, your protagonist, turns up in another character's body.
Yeah, that was such fun to do as well. The other thing I have a lot of fun with is presenting the solution to you before you've even asked the question, because it is a time travel book. So I can put the solutions right in front of you very early, and then just because you don't know what they are, there's no context for them, you don't know what they mean, and you kind of forget about them and move along. But layering that was incredibly difficult, and making sure that there was always, so even as you got a solution, you would dig into your solution and find 3 more questions behind it. That was always the sense I wanted from this book, that questions only lead to ever more questions. But it went through a lot of edits to get it to that point where that was satisfying, because the first version of it, the very first draft, was effectively a David Lynch novel. It was just vignettes, like weird, hallucinatory vignettes that didn't really connect to each other. It was crazy making, but thankfully I had 3 early readers who read it for me and could help me start to tie it up. And then it obviously went through an agent, and it went through my publisher and editors, and we got it nicely tied up so the reader can follow on without having to stress out too much about holding on to every little detail and clue.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting a very fun lesson in quantum physics, which, you know, as an English graduate, I wouldn't necessarily sit down for. Did you learn much about the potential of quantum physics and time loops and so on and so forth? Or was it all there already?
It was kind of already there. What actually happened is when I put my concept down on the page, I realised that I was going to have to go into these things because my character would wonder about it. And then you're left in a very precarious position, because how much of a novel do you want to make about those things? You have to reference them, and you kind of slightly have to explain them. But the more I talk about them, the more it becomes a science fiction novel, which I very much didn't want it to be. I wanted it to be an Agatha Christie murder mystery novel. So I had to define very clearly how much of that. And what I ended up doing was looking at 19th century philosophy. So looking at the sort of philosophy that would have been floating around in this period, and that these characters would have been aware of, and perhaps would have been, you know, the conversation. And that's kind of how I ended up defining it. I went to look at these theories that were floating around then, the predominant theories of quantum physics, of time travel, because they did have them. They were interested. They were immersed. And I kind of set my stall there. So there's no real later learning. There's nothing really coming from what we understand about it now in terms of string theory and all that sort of good stuff. It's very of a period. And that gives me a nice sort of like range of things to explore and talk about and put in the novel without feeling that I had to give you a Stephen Hawking lesson in science.
Well, it certainly works. And it's been phenomenally successful. Are you surprised how successful the book's been?
Every single day. every single minute of every single day. I honestly thought I was writing this book for about 7 people, including myself and my mum, because I just had to. I just really wanted to write it. I loved the idea of it. When I first came up with the idea of it, I assumed that somebody else had already written it, and I was half remembering a book I'd read a long time ago. So I was blown away when I sort of Googled it, and it wasn't, you know, it hadn't been done. And then from that point onwards, I had to write it. So, yeah, I mean, it's been the fact that other people have engaged with it, and the fact that it's like sparked other people's imagination has been amazing. I've had so many people who've done drawings of Blackheath and the characters, and they've sketched out things, and I had one person on Twitter who just live tweeted me his theories as he was reading the book. So just every time he thought something was happening, he would tweet me, and he was, I don't want any answers, I'm just putting this here so you know what my thought process is as I go along. And just seeing somebody engage with the book in that way, never mind the amount of people who've done it, the very fact that people just jumped aboard this roller coaster and went with it is just wonderful.
I'm reminded of some of the stories about the Victorian suspense novels of Wilkie Collins and Lady Audley's Secret, you know, the interaction that you're getting from your audience. You have created a bit of a melodramatic sensation, haven't you?
Yeah, well, not what I intended to do, but like I think that's the power of social media. I mean, social media gets a really bad rap for understandable purposes sometimes, but there's also this wonderful side to it where it allows readers to interact directly with authors. And something like this where there's a question every page, there's a possible solution every page, there's hopefully something that takes your breath away every page. Having people just come up to me through social media at the exact moment that something's happened that they've really enjoyed and tell me about it is brilliant. So yeah, it's become a real part of my experience of the book. So I only ever intended to get on Twitter to kind of market the book and then disappear, but I think I'm going to stay on it for a bit longer now.
I and many of the other Read On listeners have read the book as an audiobook, and Jot Davies is just terrific. I get the impression he was having the time of his life reading it as well. Did you have anything to do with him being selected as the narrator?
No, I didn't, but I'm so happy he was. I heard just nothing but positive stuff about his performance. Everybody, people have like come out to tell me that that was their favourite part of the book, that the way he did all the voices, the way he captured the spirit of all the characters. And actually, he was so diligent before he'd just got the job, and before he was about to record, he actually gave me a call, and he had a notepad full of questions for me on different dialects and where these characters could possibly be from in the UK, and, you know, how they would interact with each other and sort of the words they would use and intonations and just period detail. And to be honest, most of it I'd never thought about. I felt so guilty. I was just sat there listening to these brilliant questions without any brilliant answers to give him. So he has done, I'd say he's done as much work in his performance as I did actually writing the book, because there was so much I couldn't tell him that he's filled in beautifully.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Yeah, I do. So I generally have 3 books on the go. I'll have an audiobook from when I'm out sort of running or doing long walks or going to the train station. I usually have a book in the bedroom and have a book in the living room because, thanks to my daughter, as I said, I'm usually in one of those two places. So, yeah, I do love an audiobook. So I absolutely understand how, you know, the wrong narrator can destroy an audiobook. So I'm so glad I got Jot.
Stuart Turton, thank you ever so much for appearing on Read On and for writing one of the most entertaining books that I have read for years.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
I forget everything between footsteps. Anna! I finish shouting, snapping my mouth shut in surprise. My mind has gone blank. I don't know who Anna is or why I'm calling her name. I don't even know how I got here. I'm standing in a forest, shielding my eyes from the spitting rain. My heart's thumping, I reek of sweat, and my legs are shaking. I must have been running, but I can't remember why.
Jot Davies narrating The 7 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, written by my guest Stuart Turton. Thanks to HarperCollins, The 7 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is available from the RNIB Library as TB703605. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Louise Hare for the books of her life, Over the years, a number of authors have attempted to write stories featuring a blind detective, most notably Ernest Brahmer with his Max Carrados series. But few have had the insight to do so without resorting to stereotype. However, Vicky Goldie is better qualified than most, with her blinded World War I sleuth and his glamorous wife channeling both her own lived experience and Agatha Christie.
Vicky Goldie, welcome to Read On.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Red.
So, can you introduce us to Major Alistair Charters and his wife, the Honourable Melissa?
Major Alistair Charters is in his mid to late 20s. He was wounded in World War I and he was blinded. He was in the trenches and then he got recruited, because he was very good at languages, to be part of the special operations network. So he actually worked as a spy behind enemy lines. And he was attacked from behind, and unfortunately both his retinas were detached, so he was instantly blinded. He had recently married the Honourable Melissa Charters, so it's been quite a rough road for them, really, because, you know, she married this dashing major who then came back from the war blind. And for someone who was very active, as he was, it's been quite a rough ride for him. And he also has shell shock, which we today know as PTSD, which I think was part of suddenly you're this active person and then suddenly to be made blind is a terrible thing. Melissa is quite naive. She's an aristocrat. She likes to think that she's a socialist, and she helps him. She's his eyes. So when they start sleuthing, she describes things from him, and from that he works things out. And of course, like my husband, his hearing is extremely acute. So is Alistair's. So he tends to hear things and smell things, and he's also very intuitive. So he's an excellent detective.
You mention that your husband is blind and you also used to work for the R&IB Library. So unlike a lot of authors who've attempted to write blind sleuths, you have a lot of insight into how those of us who are blind don't have superpowers. We're just a lot better at, as you say, listening and interpreting the clues that our other senses provide.
Yes, that's correct. Part of the reason I started writing the books was to try and present a positive, although he's got lots of problems, Alistair, is to create a positive image about blind people are able to do lots of different things. And that's why I wanted to write books featuring someone who's blind, to create a positive image. Because so many people over the years have said to my husband, oh, you can't possibly be blind, or, oh, you can't do that, you're blind. And you think, of course he can. You know, he's not turned into an idiot just because he's blind. So I really wanted to try and write something that was positive and featured a young person who's blind. I really find it extraordinary that people think blind people are basically unable to do anything. I recently went into a bank and I was doing my husband's banking, because banks are very difficult. I don't know whether you find it so for blind people, with all the pins and this and that and everything else. So I said, well, I'm actually doing this for my husband who's blind. You know, it's very difficult that I have to do his banking for him. And she said, oh, bless. Are you his carer? I went, no, he runs a business, for goodness sake. So it really does. Every time I meet someone like that, it makes me want to write the books more, to try and show that young blind people are really go ahead and can do whatever they want.
You reflect that in Alistair and Melissa's relationship. He gets very frustrated with his inability to do the things that he used to be able to do. And Melissa is obviously there to help him, but not so much. She still, and he still, wants to be able to do things by himself.
Yes, very much so. I think it's very similar to the relationship I have with my husband, and I've always had with my husband, because, you know, he's always wanted to do things he probably shouldn't and are quite dangerous, the rest of us would think. But, you know, that's part of life and exploring it, I think, as a blind person. And as a spouse, you have to sort of stand back and let them do it, really.
And you've set the book in the golden age of crime that we associate with Poirot and Lord Peter Wimsey. And that lack of understanding of the men who've come back mutilated from the First World War, and the assumption Major Alistair just isn't there that some of the guests make, actually allows him to listen and observe almost unobserved.
Yes, he uses it to his advantage. At the beginning, the first book, he's very annoyed by it, and so is Melissa. But actually, as they begin to start their sleuthing career, they realise that they can play on this, accept this prejudice, and use it to their advantage. Of course, I think in the 1920s, it was considerably worse than it is today. And there was always the feeling that officers who did come back mutilated should really either disappear quietly somewhere or should shoot themselves, because they didn't want to be reminded of the war, which is terrible.
You're a massive fan of that golden age of crime, and there's certainly a touch of Agatha Christie's Partners in Crime, Tommy and Tuppence stories in this book, both with the whodunit element and also the humour.
Yes, I try to inject some humour, because I think what a lot of people who haven't read the books don't realise, that there is a lot of humour in the Agatha Christie books. Certainly the Poirot on television got darker and darker and darker, and now in its modern incarnation is very, very dark. But her books are, although they're dealing with murder and psychological issues, there is humour in them, which makes them easy reads and fun.
And there's always an alluring cast of characters, usually with a dubious European countess and a fusty old colonel, all gathered in a country house. And that's clearly the element that you love. Both your novels, Blind Witness and Blind Pool, are country house murders.
Yes, they are. I love the idea of there being this group of people. Someone's done it. Who was it? And then peeling back the layers and looking to see who it is.
Do you start the novel knowing who's done it, or do you allow the characters to decide for themselves as you write?
Well, with book one, I was pretty sure who did it. Then suddenly someone else did it. So not always. With book two, I was pretty sure who did it, and that person, it ended up that way. So I think sometimes when you write, the characters can sometimes take over and take you by surprise, or you see something opening that you didn't realise at the time when you did your plan of how the novel was going to go. So I think you have to be flexible and see who's going to end up being the murderer.
And what do you think are the essential ingredients for a classic whodunit?
I think you have to have a cast of disparate characters, some that you like, some that you won't like, but you need to have one character that you warm to, otherwise why would you care who got killed? I think there also has to be quite a lot of suspense. The page has to turn. You have to want to find out who did it, and that's what I think is the most important ingredient, is getting that suspense and sense of tension right, so that your reader wants to finish the book.
And do you need an isolated place, like a country house or a train travelling through the countryside?
It certainly helps, because it gives you the boundaries. Some detective novels, you're sort of ranging all across the place, and it's more about the places they visit than actually about the essential nitty-gritty of the crime and who did it.
I must say, I always like to have a creaking door or two. I think that's the essential ingredient.
Yes, absolutely.
And you've got a great eye for detail. There is wonderful descriptions of the clothes and the crockery and the house and its occupants as well. Clearly, you've done an awful lot of research into that Art Deco age.
Yes, thank you. I do love the Art Deco age, and I always have done. Many, many years ago, we lived near Portobello Road, and in the 70s, I used to do quite a lot of collecting when it was really cheap. Of course, it's now very expensive. So I love all that sort of thing. And yes, I have had to do a lot of research, mainly on silly things like what would they have done for a refrigerator? And in the second book, obviously they're cut off. And then you think, well, where did they get their electricity from? Where did they get the water from? You know, all those things that we take for granted, heat and light, in those days was quite different. So I've had to do a lot of research on boilers and electrical systems.
And when Major Alistair is doing his sleuthing, do you run his actions past your husband just to say, would you do that or would you do it slightly differently?
Yes, he is my go-to person for lots of things in the book, and he sort of edits it at the end. We go through it in minute detail, and he goes, oh, I don't think I'd have done that. So, yes, we do look at it and see. And sometimes he surprises me and said, no, I'd have done that. Why don't you get me to do this? So it's quite interesting, the things he can do.
So does he see himself as a Poirot or a Lord Peter Wimsey or maybe an Albert Campion?
No, I don't think he does. I just think he likes to sort of see what one could do in those circumstances. Crime is one of his favourite things that he reads as well, but he tends to read modern stuff rather than the older stuff.
Do you have a favourite author from the golden age of crime?
I have to say, of course, it is Agatha Christie, but I do read lots of novels that were out of print. And so I'm now reading books by E.C.R. Lorac, for example, and she writes very interesting murder mysteries. And there are lots of different books like that that we haven't been able to read for 20, 30 years. So it's fascinating. At that time, there were hundreds and hundreds of authors writing excellent murder mysteries, and Agatha was just one of them.
As far as blind detectives of yesteryear are concerned, are there any that stand out to you as having offered accurate portrayals?
It's a difficult one, that. I think probably the Inspector French novels. He is a detective and he's very solid and he's very meticulous in the way he runs his investigation. And what's quite fascinating about a detective in that period, he did it on his own mostly, you know, and he was catching the train and buses and things like that that you don't even think about. You know, he wasn't roaring around in a staff car. So I find them very interesting.
Now, you yourself were a librarian for the R&IB for some years. Yes. And the R&IB Talking Books Library was founded by a blind veteran of World War One. So did Major Alistair have his genesis in those years?
Probably, because I was actually working for the R&IB School of Physiotherapy as the librarian there. And therefore, a lot of the physiotherapists who had qualified were veterans who had been blinded through the Second World War. I knew one quite well who'd been blinded during the Mau Mau rebellion in Africa. And so I think it sat there in the back of my mind that these were people who had stories to tell and needed to be brought forth into the mind of the public.
Well, we're very fortunate that you have done so, and fingers crossed, audiobook versions of both the first novel, Blind Witness, and the second, Blind Pool, should be on the way in 2021. If you could have your perfect narrator, who would he be?
I've thought about this, and I do think it needs to probably be a man, one who has that sort of warmth, and who also is quite young, because what I really want to do was make these novels about young people, because there are so many detective stories about older people, like the excellent Richard Osman's new book, The Thursday Murder Club, but they are living in an old people's home, you know, and I think people think that's funny because of Miss Marple and Poirot being old. But I think we need to mix it up and have some nice young people solving mysteries.
And that Art Deco glamour would certainly fit the bright young things who are gathering in the country house for the murder.
Yes, absolutely. Right to be killed off.
Vicky Goldie, thank you so much for introducing us to Major Alistair Charters and his wife, the Honourable Melissa. I, for one, am certainly hoping that the audiobook versions will be forthcoming next year. But in the meantime, good luck with the third book in the trilogy.
Thank you very much.
Both Vicky Goldie's Blind Witness and Blind Pool are available commercially wherever you buy your books. Now it's back to Louise Hare for the books of her life.
Louise, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, I think one book that I often think about now, and I actually re-bought it secondhand about a year ago because I don't know what happened to my childhood copy. It's called The Friends by an author called Rosa Guy. And the reason that I fell in love with this book in particular is that up until then I'd read lots of the sort of usual stuff, Enid Blyton and those kind of things, or lots of American series like The Babysitter's Club I used to love when I was a kid. And this was the first book where it was like the two main characters, they were two friends, as the title suggests, but they were black kids growing up in New York. And on the cover, apparently it's quite a famous illustration of these two little black girls. And it was the first time I'd seen, I guess people like looked a little bit like me on a book cover where I could read about their life experiences. And I guess that's what I try and write in my fiction is I'm always trying to, I suppose, fill in those gaps that I think are missing. I love historical fiction, but it's really hard for me to find stories that have people of colour at the centre of them, although it is getting easier. So this was a book that really first showed me that I could potentially write about people that look like me.
Unfortunately, The Friends by Rosa Guy is not available in audio, but the RNIB has another of her titles, My Love, My Love, which is narrated by Helen Kopp.
The peasant girl stopped raking through the sandy soil and smiled. The banter between the old couple amused her. Tonton Julian saw her smiling and smiled too, exposing his two remaining teeth. Then he walked towards his old mule, tied to the post behind their mud hut, touching the peasant girl gently on her head as he passed. She followed his movements, his bony thighs that showed through the flapping tear of his ragged pants as he walked, the dry skin of his feet as he swung his long frame onto his mule. She liked the way he adjusted his straw hat to keep the open crown away from the top of his head. Then she stopped seeing. A car was racing past on the distant road. She strained, listening to the fading sound of its engine. Her eyes were alert, shining. A car! A car! From what unknown place had it come? To what strange place was it going? Oh, to be flying against the wind in a car! To be rushing off to a city, a town.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, so I have recently reread, and I love it, and I've seen various versions, televised versions and the film version, of Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, because I feel like it's potentially the perfect novel, if such a thing exists, because it's historical. The writing is so atmospheric, and it doesn't shy away from how bad Victorian times were in London if you had no money. You know, it starts off in like a baby farm, and the main character is basically a pickpocket, a fingersmith. And she gets involved in this scheme to rip off this wealthy heiress. But things aren't as they seem, and it's got the best twist that comes about halfway through the novel. Even once you know what's going to happen, it still surprises you, even though you're waiting for it to happen. When it does happen, you're still like, oh, I can't understand how I didn't get it the first time. Like, you know, it's just so, it's so brilliant. So that's always a book that I go back to.
My name, in those days, was Susan Trinder. People called me Sue. I know the year I was born in, but for many years I did not know the date and took my birthday to be Christmas. I believe I'm an orphan. My mother I know is dead, but I never saw her. She was nothing to me. I was Mrs. Saxby's child, if I was anyone's. And for father, I had Mr. Ibbs, who kept the locksmith's shop at Lant Street in the borough, near to the Thames. This is the first time I remember thinking about the world and my place in it. It was a girl named Flora who paid Mrs. Saxby a penny to take me begging at a play. People used to like to take me begging then, for the sake of my bright hair. and Flora, being also very fair, would pass me off as her sister.
Rachel Atkins narrating Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, so one that I've read really recently, partly because it also ties in with Miss Aldridge's Regrets, it's called Vine Street by Dominic Nolan. It's set over decades, to be honest. It's an epic crime novel, just brilliantly written. And again, there is a twist in this as well that I didn't quite figure out before it happened. So it starts in 1930 Soho. There's a serial killer happening. So you're following with the police, but then getting to know all of these characters. And then there are some real life people in there as well who crop up. Because obviously the great thing with Soho at that time was that people would go to even the sleazy clubs, places where Lena worked. You know, you would sometimes get wealthy people going there and famous people going there because they wanted to experience real jazz and that kind of thing. So it's just a wonderful book. If you love a crime novel, but with fantastic characters, I'd really recommend that.
Rathbun shifts to the edge of his seat, leaning in. Mrs. Cassell, did you know your husband's partner, Leon Geats?
Oh, yes. I knew Leon very well. Worked with him before I ever met Mark. All three of us run a case together in, oh, goodness, when must it have been? 1935, 1936? Scarcely seems believable, does it?
Have you seen much of him over the years?
Leon? Oh, heavens, no. He left the force before the war. I saw him briefly afterwards. He had just been demobbed and looked us up.
She frowns.
He dropped out of sight after that.
Demobbed? We didn't find any record of him serving during the war, which is strange, because he was of the right age.
Billy shrugs. I can only go by what he told me, which, to be frank, was very little. Leon always held his cards close to his chest.
Owen Finley narrating Vine Street by Dominic Nolan, which is available commercially.
Louise Hare, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.